Tonight, we ask the question, can we have morality without God? Is it possible for any sort of binding morality to exist if there is no God? Just by way of introduction, I'm going to read to you a little bit from McLaughlin, from the book we're reading. And I've got a few quotes tonight, so I hope everybody will bear with me. Here's the question we're asking, right? Or some of the background for the question we're asking. How about that? McLaughlin says this on page 60. In 1999, Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg made this claim. Religion is an insult to human dignity. With or without it, you would have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. But for good people to do evil things, that takes religion. I understand why someone would say that, right? Because if we're being honest, and I think it's important for Christians to be intellectually honest, okay? Bible says, let your reasonableness be known to all people, right? And I always say, we don't always do our best work there in Christian circles. If we're being honest, the name of God has been used a lot in human history, and even the name of Christ in Christian history has been used a lot to justify pretty horrible things, okay? I think sometimes people overstate it a little bit. I think sometimes not all of the critiques are necessarily fair. I don't blame Christianity for all of it, right? But I do blame people who use Christianity. So I can see how someone would see religion as a problem in that way. But at the same time, I actually think the best argument you can make here is that evil is a human problem. And that seemingly good people doing evil things is a human problem. Because we, in sort of modern Western civilization, we have... How do I phrase this? We have sort of bought into the lie that as human beings progress, as we become more educated, as we become more enlightened, that evil will wane, and sort of atrocities. Let's just talk about that. Let's talk about it in that sense. Atrocities will wane, and that the more educated and the more enlightened we are, the less sort of atrocities would happen. That would make sense, right? And then if it weren't for World War II, is what I usually like to say. One of the craziest things about, you know, when we hear about genocides and things like that, even in modern society, we think about them in terms of something that would happen in a third world country or a banana republic or in some sort of a religious dictatorship or something like that. Even as Christians, sometimes we give in to that sort of prejudice. But the problem is that Nazi Germany developed in a very modern, for the times, right, Western enlightened civilization. This was one of the things that people had the hardest time getting their minds around, is how could this happen in Germany of all places? If you read about German culture pre-war, I mean, it was really this beautiful, amazing place. You read about the lives of people before the war in Germany, it's highly educated, highly refined, high society. So many beautiful cultural things came from Germany. And so then for Germany to turn into Nazi Germany, right, is something that kind of blows up this idea of enlightenment. On top of all that, to say that religion is primarily responsible for the atrocities in the world glosses over virtually the entirety of the 20th century, right? The Nazi Party was very much not Christian. Now, did they co-opt Christianity? Yes, they did. But the leaders of the Nazi Party themselves were pagans, a-religious, saw religion as a weakness, were anti-religious, obviously, in lots of different ways. Think about Stalin in Russia. Because he sort of helped us out in World War II, sometimes we give a little bit of a pass to the atrocities of the Soviet Union, but Stalin was represented... was responsible for the murder of millions as well, right? Obviously the USSR was known for its godlessness. You go on to you know, situations like Pol Pot and Cambodia and others, atheism and irreligiousness is as responsible for as much bloodshed in the modern age, or more bloodshed than anything else, certainly much more than Christianity. So you may say something like what this guy says in this book. You may agree with it to some degree, or you may find yourself agreeing with it to some degree. The problem is that it just doesn't hold water when you decide you want to embrace the alternative. It's just as, it's more bloody than religion. So it still begs the question, can we have morality without God? Someone like the gentleman that McLaughlin quoted, I can't pull his name up right now, Weinberg, obviously would say religion's an insult to human dignity. But one thing I think it's important to say, he says you'd have evil people doing evil things and good people doing good things. It kind of reminds me of one of my favorite jokes where some scientists come to God and they say, we don't need you anymore, we can make man. And God says, okay, that's great, let's see it. And so they say, okay. So they go and they get a shovel and they come back with a bucket full of dirt. And God says, wait just a minute, get your own dirt. And what I kind of want to say to this guy is get your own categories, right? What does evil even mean if there is no God? We get these categories from the Bible. So someone like Weinberg is more indebted to the Bible than we think. I read a really fascinating book a year or two ago by Tom Holland, not Spider-Man, a different Tom Holland. At the time, I know Holland was not a believer when he wrote the book. I've not kept up with him since then enough. I've not heard anything about him being converted, but I thought I saw something recently about the possibility he's becoming more open to Christianity. So don't hold me to whether he's a Christian at this point or not. I believe that he's still a secular non-Christian, perhaps even an atheist. But he wrote this book called Dominion, and it's a book about how Christianity shaped Western civilization and modern thought. And it's one of the most compelling books I've read in a long, long time. And he talks about how the Western conception of morality, and if you think about this, I feel like, as polarized politically in America as we've been maybe since the Civil War. It's a really polarized time. At least as polarized as we've been since the 60s, which were another very polarized time. Real tumultuous time, too, you know, politically and in society, the 60s were. So we're in a really tumultuous, though, time that's at least comparable to some of the more tumultuous times we've had since the Civil War. And even then, I still find it intriguing that so much of our political discourse at this point is no longer about policy primarily, or what we feel like is best for the country. So much of it is centered around what people believe is right and wrong. Now, I don't think that's all bad, okay? I think it's good to have moral discussions. But I think we all sort of recognize that we're at a place where the platforms of our two parties are very different. And there's problems with both parties, by the way. I mean, we all recognize that and see that. I don't try to sort of morally equivocate there. If anyone's wondering if I'm trying to, like, back out of giving any kind of clarity on where I stand on issues or whatever else, I always say I'm a single-issue non-voter. If you're pro-life, it doesn't guarantee that I'll vote for you, but if you're not, if you're pro-choice, it guarantees I won't vote for you. How about that? So that's I used to say I was a single-issue voter, but now I'm a single-issue non-voter because I can't promise you just because you say you're pro-life I'm going to vote for you. But I can't personally endorse, or I don't endorse candidates anyway, but I couldn't vote for someone who would actively work toward increasing abortion. So just so that's clear, in case some, you know, people are like blasting pastors on the internet all the time now about not being clear on some of this stuff. So just in case y'all are on Twitter or X or whatever it's called now, and they're like, if your pastor does this, run, or whatever. Okay, I'm being clear. So I find it intriguing, though, still, right, that someone on, even now, we expect it from the right because the right has tended toward being more religious in recent years. And it feels like, at least on the platform and in the kind of elite folks at the party level, that the Democratic Party has been a little less prone toward talking about religion. Whether that's good or bad, that's up to you to decide. And even so, the debate is still characterized, right, over right and wrong. And I've noticed an increase in talking about religion on the left as well, and laying claims, right, to morality, and that doing this is evil or doing that is really good or whatever else. And the reality is, whatever it is that we're doing and whatever it is we're talking about, we cannot escape moral categories. And these are moral, this is a point I'm trying to make. And those moral categories, we are still beholden to moral categories that essentially come from the Bible. If you talk to non-monotheistic religious people, they tend to think a lot less in terms of good and evil and a lot more in terms of a spectrum and that sort of thing. We can't escape good and evil. And on top of all that, if you were a pure materialist, a pure secularist, right, an evolutionist or whatever else you want to call it, completely irreligious, and you believe all there is stuff, okay, that there's no special endowment to human beings by a creator, then let me phrase it like this. Can you imagine a world where you called a baboon wicked? You know, now I didn't say, can you imagine a world where you see a baboon in wicked? Okay, that's very possible. I'm saying, can you imagine a world where you, imagine a world where you call a dog evil? No, right? A dog's just do what dogs do, right? Now there might be a dog that's dangerous, right? But if you have to have a dog put down because it's biting people or mauling people or whatever else, you know, you don't say this dog has proven its unfitness for human society and it's a scourge on the earth. No, you just say this dog is too dangerous to live in the sort of domesticated world, right? I hate it for the dog, but that's what happens. I'll tell you, my dog's gotten loose before in the neighborhood. Couldn't find my dog. And I've stopped looking for it. Now, I've never done that with a child. I wouldn't do that with a child, right? You know, I would keep looking for my child. But I've gone home and been like, all right, he's just going to have to come back. You know, I can't find him. I don't know where he is. And we'll just pray, go home and pray. Why? Because we recognize there's a difference between a human and an animal, right? I love my dogs. My primary incentive, as much as I love my dogs, I don't want to lose a dog. I don't want my dog to run away. But I also, my biggest thing is I don't want to have to come home and tell my kids that their dog is gone. You know what I mean? That's my biggest thing I don't want to do. Or my wife, or my wife's mother, for that matter. And so I don't want to console any of these people over the dogs. And so it's still, right? You can't imagine a world where you would call one of these things evil or wicked. So if all you have is this idea that human beings are another creature that's evolved from whatever sort of common ancestor we might have with a baboon or a chimpanzee or whatever else, if that's all you believe, then how can you even say, how can you even have a category for evil people doing evil things or good people doing good things, right? There is nothing at that point to differentiate a human being from something else. And someone might say something like, well, we're sentient, or we have a bicameral mind, or we're aware of things, or whatever else. And I guess my answer to that would be, what evidence do you have that there's not some comparable level of intelligence or whatever else in some other creature? And in fact, there are arguments to that end. I've mentioned this in this class already, but it bears repeating. There's an ethicist named Peter Singer. I don't know if Singer's still alive or not, but it was at Princeton. Okay, this guy wasn't at Cuckoo Bird University, okay? He was an ethicist at Princeton. So a cultural elite. And he argued that a child, a human child up to 2 years old, should be awarded no more rights than a pig because they're at the same cognitive ability level. Well, for all of us, that sounds crazy, right? But if all you have is we're stuff made of stuff and we're animals and there is no ordered meaning imposed on this globe by someone who owns it and made it and made us a certain way, then what real argument do you have that it is wicked or evil to treat a one-year-old differently than you would treat a pig? What evidence do we have for that? Singer's being, he's wrong. He's devilishly wrong. But he's at least consistent, and he's got the guts to be consistent. Whereas most of our society scoffs at it, but doesn't even know why they're scoffing, or a significant portion of our society. So I think there is a moral argument to be made that God exists, and I think our sort of moral impulses. The other thing I feel like I need to address is, hey, Whit, will you raise your hand at 5 till? I'm not using my iPad, you know, and I'm afraid I feel a good head of steam coming on here, you know, and I'm not Forrest Gump this thing, just run straight through the back of the end zone, you know, just keep going. I think, and we're going to talk about this by the end of the night, one other issue we would need to address about this is someone might say, well, sure, you can have morality without God, right? The only reason we all think this way is just because we've been conditioned to think this way by living in a Christian society. But one thing I think I'm going to argue later is that while we do think morally in Christian categories, there is no amoral society. There's societies with different morals, okay, that think about morality different, but there is no amoral society, right? Lewis says this in Mere Christianity. I'm going to quote from this, and I might actually quote this later, which in case you get to hear it twice. But he says there may be societies in which a man can have more than one wife, right? Or can have this or have that. There's no society in which a man can have any wife he chooses or any woman he pleases, right? There's no society where that's the case. There are taboos, there are morals universally in human society in a way that differentiates from other creatures. We have to have some account for that morality. Okay. So, Keller. Tim Keller. That is. Makes a moral argument for God. That's going to kind of be our outline tonight. He says in its most basic form, the moral argument for the existence of God can be presented in two premises and a conclusion. Number one, if there are objectively binding moral obligations, then God exists. There are objectively binding moral obligations, therefore God exists. Kind of a syllogism. So if there are objectively binding moral obligations, then God exists. There are objectively binding moral obligations, therefore God exists. So that's going to sort of help. It's going to kind of help frame sort of how we're thinking tonight. Let me say this. Our society is such a mixed bag on this. Because, and I should have saved it for tonight, but I talked about this Portlandia sketch a few weeks ago, where the murderer across the hall from this woman keeps saying, I'm just living my truth, right? You do you. I'm just living my truth or whatever. And by the end of it, the lady says, what about my truth, you know? And the cops say, yeah, you're going to have to leave. I think you need to move, ma'am, you know? At some point, right, there has to be, we all crave and long for some sort of objective morality, right? While at the same time saying things like, you know, what's true for me is true for me. What's true for you is true for you. Or you need to live your truth, or you need to do you, or how do we even know? We sort of talk out both sides of our mouth societally. But how could there be? We have to ask this question: how could there be objective morality without God? And when it comes to morals, we need to make a distinction. There's first of all, the difference between objective and subjective morals, okay? I talk about this in premarital counseling a lot, Okay, and maybe this would be a really good illustration for all of us here. I always tell everyone, we tend to assign morality to our upbringing. Okay? We tend to see the way we were raised as a moral situation. Have you ever said to your spouse or to someone else, I just wasn't raised that way? Has anybody ever said that before? That's just not the way I was raised, right? I've said it before. Whitney said it before. You've heard someone say that, right? What are you kind of saying when you say that? That's wrong to do that. I wasn't raised that way. Now, is it true that oftentimes the way we were raised is reflective of objectively true things? Sure. If somebody's like, oh, we can just bend the truth on this. And you say, I wasn't raised that way. You were raised not to lie, right? That's a good thing. That's objective. But there are other things that aren't so objective in the way we were raised, right? And I would say to them, just because your parents did it a certain way and your household did it a certain way doesn't mean it's objectively true and good and right. It might be a good way to do something, right? But it's not necessarily the only way to do it. So I'm trying to think of here's an example. You know, when I was a kid, we would ride by the fair. And I would say, Dad, can we go to the fair? And Dad would say, we don't go to the fair. We're Alexanders. And like I said, I still don't know what that means, right? I still don't know what he meant by that, right? But what I guess he was getting at is, I don't want to go to the fair. I don't want to spend all that money, so we're not going to the fair, right? Now, if Whitney had said, I really would love to go to the fair, and I said, well, I wasn't raised that way, right? Well, that is subjective morality. Is everybody with me? I know people for whom something like buying fireworks, okay? They're like, that's a waste of money. I wasn't raised that way. That's not the kind of thing we're going to do, all right? So for any kind of frivolous spending, right? I mean, these are things we deal with in premarital counseling, you know? Those kinds of things are often things that people have big fights about. Why? Because when you're raised a certain way, when you have these subjective morals, like it's frivolous and wasteful to buy fireworks, right? Some people think that. Or it's the safety risks of fireworks are not worth the joy of you know, watching fireworks on New Year's Eve. Whatever. Well, that is subjective morality. Is everybody with me? That is not something that's objectively true at all times. Because the argument can also be made, it's a good thing to celebrate. Right? It's a beautiful thing to celebrate. It's a good thing sometimes. I think there are times when spending money in a frivolous way is a good thing, right? That we do that at times. It's good to celebrate. I preached just a couple weeks ago on a division on this kind of issue among the disciples, right? When the woman poured out her jar of ointment on the Lord and rubbed it on his head and on his feet. And people said, that money could have been used to give to the poor, right? And Jesus says what? She has done a beautiful thing. This is what some would have seen as a frivolous spending of money and others would have seen as a good thing. These kind of debates rip through churches at times, right? Should a church have stained glass windows? Should a church do this? We could take this amount of money and you spend it on... These are debates we have all the time where there's subjective and objective morality involved. Objectively, right? It is wrong and sinful to lie. It's wrong and sinful to steal. So if you want to have a beautiful 4th of July and you steal to buy fireworks, that's a sin, right? And if you say, I wasn't raised that way, you're talking about objective morality. But if you say, we've got plenty of money, we've got some, I get it, money to burn, pun intended, you know, to bring some joy and to celebrate America and to have a good time with our kids and bless the neighborhood up until a certain hour, you know, or conversely, enrage the neighborhood after a certain hour, whatever, then God, there's God's glories in that, right? That's subjective morality. That's something that can change from moment to moment. So that's one distinction we need to make when it comes to morals. I will never say that subjective morality is impossible without God. It's entirely possible without God, right? I mean, there's a sense in which animals have territories. They have taboo, like they have things you shouldn't do around them, right? There are mistakes you can make. So subjective morality, to some degree, is entirely possible based on our whims and fancies, on our culture, on just man's wisdom, all those kind of things. Those are all possible without God. But I say that. And there's another sense in which if we're just... Maybe I'm stealing my own thunder here. But think about this. If we're just made of atoms and stuff, stardust or whatever it is that we're supposed to be made out of, where would the idea of right and wrong even come from? Where would any thought come? In other words, how could we conceive of something that's not stuff? Do you see what I'm trying to say? Like, in other words, how could we understand anything that's not also made out of molecules if there's not something out there that's not made of molecules? Right? If there's not something metaphysical, something beyond the physical. And I think morality, even just the very idea of saying something is right or wrong, is something that's a signpost pointing us to our createdness and to the reality that there's something outside stuff. Okay. Objective versus subjective. Is that clear? But objective morality, I think, is impossible without God. Then there's two different kinds of distinct... There's two aspects to morality. One is values and worth. So values and worth would be like determining whether something's good or bad. And then duties and obligations. That's determining whether something's right or wrong. Good and bad versus right and wrong. Values and worth versus duties and obligations. I think objective moral values require God. Now, let me say this. What some people think we're saying when we say this is, and this is a lot of atheists say this, and sometimes Christians make this argument, that basically what we're saying is you have to believe in God to have morality. That's essentially what the Weinberg guy was saying in McLaughlin's quote, right? That's what he's arguing against. The idea that you have to believe in God to have any sort of morality. Well, that's false on its face, right? Well, I know plenty of people who are moral people who do not believe in the Christian God, okay? There are good people in the world, honest people, helpful people, kind people, loving people, people who do moral things who do not believe in God, and even more who don't believe in the Christian God. Okay? So you hear people talk all the time about being a decent human being. Now, by the way, what I'm not saying is that those people are perfect people, and I'm certainly not saying that they aren't sinners, right? What I'm saying, by any objective sort of societal standard, we'd say that's a good dude, you know? I've known people over the years that I would trust with my life, right, who weren't Christians. So what I'm not saying is you have to believe in God for morality to be possible. I think it's one of the conceits of the arguments of a lot of atheists is they think that what we're saying is you have to believe in God to have morals. I don't think that's true. But what I'm saying is God has to exist for morals to exist. And what I mean by that is there has to be something beyond us and outside us that's given us this sense. Again, if we're merely physical creatures, if all we are is just reconstituted primordial ooze or stardust or whatever it is we are, then it makes no sense to me why we would have any conception of something beyond this place. It would also make little sense to me why it would be so universal. There would be such a universal sense of otherness and metaphysical. What I think some people think is also that we're saying that God just arbitrarily decrees what is good or bad. That at the beginning of time, if God had wanted to, right, he could have said, well, lying is actually good. And telling the truth is bad, if God had chosen to do that. What I think the Bible teaches and what I think is true is that God himself is the standard of what is right and wrong and good and bad. It's not like God just came up with good and bad or whatever else. No, morality is a revelation of God's own character. And God himself is the standard of right and wrong. God himself is the standard of good and bad. I alluded to this earlier, but I think it bears revisiting, that one sort of alternative to this is what philosophers or theologians have called atheistic moral Platonism, which is essentially the idea that there's just these ideal morals that sort of exist outside us, sort of like, I don't know how familiar y'all would be with Plato. I don't know. I'm not trying to be insulting. I just don't know. But Plato, any philosophy 101 folks in here, you know, if you've taken philosophy at all, the one thing you definitely learned about was Plato's cave. All right. So Plato believed that the physical world was a reflection of the true world, and that we sort of were in a cave, and that all that we saw in the physical world was sort of a shadow. So he says, imagine you're in a cave, and there's a fire in the cave, and there's stuff going on you can't see, but you see the shadows of it. He's saying the physical world is the shadow, but reality is out beyond us. We can't see it. Have y'all heard the phrase like Platonic ideal before? The Platonic ideal is whatever is casting that shadow, right? So Plato would have held to something metaphysical out there, a logos, something like a god or a force or something that represented those things. What some people argue is that there's, I think it was William Lane Craig that I learned this idea from. How would he ask the question, if that's the case and there is no God at all, how would these morals that exist out there, how would they exist materially? How could there be some sense of morality? I'll say this, that probably the most compelling non-theistic view of morality that I've ever heard is essentially the idea that the objective morality we have as humans is basically just the aggregate of the subjective morality of all humans from all time. And that we just sort of pick all that up in our DNA and imparted wisdom and everything else. That's as compelling as it gets, but I still feel like it falls far short. Sorry, this hot air blowing on me is frying my brain. So how would principles like this exist materially? How does stardust create its truth? It's bad to lie. How does stardust create its wrong to murder? How is there anything outside whatever exists in our brains or whatever exists in the earth? It becomes nonsensical. And then let's just say that these ideals do exist. Let's say there are morals out there somewhere. What exactly is it that would obligate us to follow them if there is no God? What reason do we have, right? Like, why would we? So why would we have, like, the duty to do these things just because they existed somewhere? Whitney and I watched this really weird show earlier this year called Pluribus. And was it really weird, or do you know where I'm going with this? Is that what gave it away, that I said really weird, or you know where I'm headed? Anyway, if you watch the first episode, I don't want to spoil it. You can put your fingers in your ears or whatever. I'm not going to give much away, but I won't give hardly anything away. This is like first, you see this in the trailer. They intercept a code from space in Pluribus. And they start cracking the code, and then they start running tests to try to figure out what the code is. They finally figure out what it is. They start running these tests. What obligation did they have to do that? Right? And there's just this code they intercepted, curiosity, whatever else. But was there a moral obligation to just this code's coming from space? By the way, they probably shouldn't have done it, but you'll have to watch the show. I can't remember. I don't know. You guys may have, like, I think there is some bad language, so language warning in that show. And themes and stuff like that, adult themes, but grown up themes. Don't watch it with the kids. But let me say all that to say, like, what obligation you if you just hear some code, or if a message in a bottle comes up to you on the beach, right? And it says, "Send me $100," and gives you the address. What obligation do you have to do that? Well, you don't really have, right? You don't really have one. So if we did discover some morality that's not from God, but it just exists out there, if we just found the cave, right, and saw the stuff, what obligation do we have to do that if there's nothing binding on us? And somebody might say, well, it just means being a good person. And again, if we're no different than a monkey, or we're no different than a wolf or whatever, what does being a good person even mean? Right? A friend of mine from seminary had kids and a wife. And he was helping some people on the side of the road. And 18-wheeler came through. And he heroically saved the people he was helping and lost his life. Right? If we're just primates, right? And everyone in here, right? I hear the, like the Baptist mms, you know? Like it means something to us to know he did that. And I think about what John did a lot, and I have close friends that were even closer to John, and they commemorate him in all kinds of really cool ways and honor and respect what he did. And, you know, they talk to his sons about what their dad did. And all of us here, none of us here are saying, why would he do that to the pack? Right? Why would he betray his bloodline like that? No, we're all saying, what a hero. To sacrifice himself for strangers. Why? Why would we say it was a good thing for him to do? Because it's the right thing to do, right? We see it as heroic. We see it as a good, positive thing. If we're just primates, it's not a good thing to do. Right? Primates would not sacrifice themselves for somebody else's people, for another pack, for someone else. It's not what nature is designed to do. We're designed to protect our DNA, right? Okay. So, there's something going on outside here. Let me read to you a little bit really quickly from William Lane Craig about this. Maybe he'll make more sense than me. It's far more plausible to think that both the natural realm and the moral realm are under the authority of a God who gave us both the laws of nature and the moral law than to think that these are two independent realms that just happen to mesh. And this is the point that Craig's making, is that God feels much more likely that this idea of objective morality is from God than that it just happened to occur. Let me say this as well. Say something about human rights. Something that as Americans we hold very highly, right? Have a high view of human rights. We, at least ours, you know. I've never met anybody that doesn't believe in their human rights. Sometimes we're iffier on other people's. I understand that. But we all love, as Americans, the idea of universal human rights, right? In fact, if you look at sort of American foreign policy in our lifetimes primarily, one of the great surprises that we all have all the time is that, as Americans, is that when freedom and democracy is available to people, how rarely it feels like they choose it, right? It's baffling, and I think it's baffled American foreign policy. Over time, I do think that we underestimate greatly as Westerners how deeply shaped by Christianity Western ideals are, and how dependent on Christianity ideas of democracy and freedom are. And then when we try to import them somewhere else, I don't know how anyone feels about the heart behind those things. I tend to think that when people say this, maybe I'm an optimist, I tend toward thinking that people think it's a good thing, right? That assimilating into Western culture or bringing democracy to places is a good thing, because we like it for us. We like freedom for us. Over and over again, though, right? Trying to impose these ideas on other cultures, good ideas though they may be, seems to fail more often than not. And essentially, I think that is because universalizing human rights is impossible without Judeo-Christian underpinnings. And so if you look and you think see freedom as a good thing, I don't think it's just because we're Westerners. I think it's because it's a good thing. Other people are conditioned to think differently. But on the whole, human rights, which we all see as an objective good, are impossible without some form of understanding of who God is and Christianity. And that's an idea I've borrowed largely from McLaughlin. Let me read to you really quickly also from McLaughlin. I've got all my books up here. Getting close. I'm going to try not to gump this thing. Let's see. Here's McLaughlin on the idea of evolutionary altruism. Atheist psychologist Steven Pinker uncovers one of the inherent fault lines in that conclusion, which is the idea that essentially atheistic or evolutionary altruism is the idea that we're nice to each other or kind to one another, we'd sacrifice ourselves for somebody on the side of the interstate, simply because over time, that evolutionary process actually benefits from that. So the atheist psychologist Steven Pinker uncovers one of the inherent fault lines in that conclusion. He points out that if virtue is equated with sacrifices that benefit one's own group in competition with other groups, then fascism would be the ultimate virtuous ideology. Something I don't think any of us like, okay? Pinker describes our innate moral sense like this. Whatever sense of empathy nature bequeathed us by default applies to a very narrow circle of individuals, pretty much our family and close allies within the clan or village. A convinced secular humanist, Pinker believes that universal human rights can be grounded in reason without appeal to God by progressively expanding the circle. I think that breaks down again because, like he says, ultimately, we would find things beautiful that we don't find beautiful, like fascism. Because we would look and we would say, I remember one time I used to be friends with some atheists on the internet. There's this group or message board or something that they had, and I would post on there sometimes. And I guess there's a guy I met in person, and I would just try to share the gospel in these places. I remember they were talking about some NFL player that was making boo-koodles of money. And they were talking about how awful that was. You know, this is ridiculous that somebody can make this much money playing football. And I remember thinking to myself in that moment, like, well, you know, in the modern world, the survival of the fittest, you know, we don't have to beat each other with, you know, animal femurs to get to the food supply, right? We don't have to fight people off from the water supply or whatever else. But I said, I posted finally on that message board and said, how are you guys finding this to be so immoral when it feels like it could easily be a very natural progression of the idea of survival of the fittest, right? The most fit and strong and excellent people in our culture and society have found a way not to outrun people to prey or not to look better to women or whatever else, even though I'm sure there's some of that going on in sports leagues. I'm not that familiar with that lifestyle, but I'm sure there's plenty of some of those things happening. But I said, now they found a way to take that and turn it into millions of dollars, right? The modern equivalent of beating everyone to the resources. And the guy just said back, don't embarrass yourself, which is usually a sign you've won an argument. I say all that to say, it's not, the idea of evolutionary altruism to me makes no sense in the end, simply because, maybe most compellingly for me, what I still don't understand is why we find sacrifice to be beautiful. Right? That I don't understand why we would have these emotive responses. We would see this as a beautiful thing. I can understand that we might find it necessary. I can understand it might be something we do from time to time, but I don't understand why we would find it beautiful. And let me conclude like this. I'm going to conclude with C.S. Lewis, who's, as the kids say, the goat. Might be what the kids said 5 years ago at this point. I'm not sure. I'm 40, and I don't know. But how about this? How about we end with this? Oh, 5 minutes. Thanks, babe. Our experience, I got so excited. I thought you had an insightful comment, but it's just notification that I've gone too long, or almost too long. Actually, I'm going to end right on time. In the end, how about this? Our experience and our own brains teach us that there's objective morality. And maybe this is kind of coming full circle a little bit. This is C.S. Lewis. This is Mere Christianity. I read this book a long time ago, and these what Lewis talks about has stuck with me ever since then. That's not page 3. That's the foreword. This is from the very, very first chapter, very first paragraph of Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis. Everyone has heard people quarreling. Okay, some of us probably more recently than others, if you have little kids at home. Sometimes it sounds funny, and sometimes it sounds merely unpleasant. But however it sounds, I believe we can learn something very important from listening to the kinds of things they say. They say things like this. How'd you like it if anyone did the same to you? That's my seat. I was there first. Leave him alone. He isn't doing you any harm. Why should you shove in first? Give me a bit of your orange. I gave you a bit of mine. Come on, you promised. People say things like that every day, educated people as well as uneducated, and children as well as grown-ups. Now, what interests me about all these remarks is that the man who makes them is not merely saying that the other man's behavior does not happen to please him. He is appealing to some kind of standard of behavior which he expects the other man to know about. And the other man very seldom replies, British have a little different standard than modern American evangelicals about swear words, so I'm going to edit Lewis here. To heck with your standard. Nearly always he tries to make out that what he has been doing does not really go against the standard, or if it does, there is some special excuse. What's Lewis saying? He's saying the equivalent of George Costanza yelling out, we live in a society, right? There's a standard outside us that we have to live by. He goes on and gives more of an example. The most remarkable thing is this. Whenever you find a man who says he does not believe in a real right and wrong, you will find the same man going back on this a moment later. He may break his promise to you, but if you try breaking one to him, he will be complaining, it's not fair, before you can say Jack Robinson. I love the Brits. Sometimes vulgar, sometimes so wholesome. All right. A nation may say treaties don't matter, but then next minute they spoil their case by saying that the particular treaty they want to break was an unfair one. But if treaties do not matter, and if there's no such thing as right and wrong, in other words, if there is no law of nature or natural law, what is the difference between a fair treaty and an unfair one? Have they not let the cat out of the bag and shown that, whatever they say, they really know the law of nature just like anyone else? Here's the reality. We recognize as human beings that without some... Everyone who says they want to live with no morality, at the end of the day, actually doesn't want to live in that world, right? Nobody wants to live in the purge. Nobody actually wants to live in an anarchist society. And even among the anarchists, right, there are rules. You know, you go to homeless camps in Portland and you have to check in on a laptop still. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't matter how far out people want to be or whatever else, there still has to be some sort of order, some sort of objectivity. I think there's plenty of compelling evidence, and even more than this, that, and if as you read McLaughlin, you'll see any more, that we feel in our hearts, that we see by nature, has to have come from God. Thanks, y'all. Any questions or thoughts? Man.